This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Typically, we associate philanthropy with the famous industrialists of the 19th and 20th centuries, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Fords, and the DuPonts. Here in North Carolina, it was the Dukes, the Reynolds, the Keenans. Our state's most established and traditional philanthropists endowed universities, hospitals, as well as the arts. But the sources of philanthropy and the process through which money is donated have changed over the past few decades. In North Carolina, companies based in Research Triangle Park brought a different kind of philanthropy to the state, with science and healthcare as a significant focus of their charity. And philanthropy changes still. With us to talk about philanthropy, we have Todd Cohen, who is the editor and publisher of the Philanthropy Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we welcome your emails today. Our email address is sot@wunc.org. That's sot@wunc.org. Well, Todd, when we think about philanthropy, who's the first person that comes to mind?
In North Carolina?
Well, yes.
It's probably unfair to ask me that question because my job is to report on these things. Mm-hmm. But I think for the purposes of the audience here, everyone is a philanthropist, or everyone can certainly be a philanthropist. I mean, there are the Rockefellers and the Fords and the Carnegies on a national level, and the Keenans and the Dukes and the Reynolds in terms of the state. But really, philanthropy is changing. It's changing dramatically, and it's involving a lot more people. You don't have to be a Rockefeller, as many people have said, to be a philanthropist.
Mm-hmm. But in North Carolina, we have institutions that to this day carry on the names, the Dukes, Reynolds, the Keenans. There are buildings with their names on it, these industrialists or businessmen who gave back to the community and offered money to build these things. What's the tradition of philanthropy in North Carolina?
Well, philanthropy in North Carolina has a long and strong tradition. It's an unusual state because it has such a strong tradition of philanthropy. Not only are there the foundations that were created by some of the individuals and families you just mentioned, but there are also companies in the state that are generous philanthropists and individuals. And as time has changed and wealth has grown and people have moved into the state, there's also a new kind of philanthropy and a new way of giving.
And what is that?
Traditionally, foundations in the state gave money to do exactly the sorts of things that you mentioned in your introduction, build hospitals and support cultural institutions and support charities that existed and were created to address basic human needs. Hunger and homelessness and health and education and those sorts of things. Over time, with the growth of new companies to the area, companies moving to the area and setting up operations that were located somewhere else, and individuals who created wealth through high technology companies and the like, there's a different way of giving money away. These days, donors tend to be more engaged and want to be more involved with the nonprofits that they support.
And we're talking here the people who give significant sums of money who want to be more involved.
But
or everybody.
I think it's true of everyone. Yeah. I think it's true of everyone. Now this is a growing trend, and I don't mean to suggest that this is the case with all individual donors or all institutional donors, whether they're companies or foundations. But increasingly, people and organizations that give money away want to get to be more involved with the charities that they support, and also to know more from the charities about what the impact is that they're having.
One reads about venture capitalists, and are there venture philanthropists?
Absolutely.
Is that this kind of person that you're talking about? It wants to make sure the money is directed in a very specific way?
Yes. Venture capitalists, in fact, are probably helping to set the trend in terms of that kind of involvement, but they're not the only force that's involved. But yes, venture philanthropists tend to participate more than traditional philanthropists and donors in the charities that they support. But there's also an increasing interest on the part of donors and institutional funders to better support the operations of nonprofit organizations to try to make them stronger in terms of their internal operations, what they refer to as their their organizational capacity and effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. Todd Cohen is with us. He is with Philanthropy Journal, which is an online publication that covers the philanthropy, well, not industry, but the philanthropy.
Industry is a fine word. It's the business of philanthropy.
Okay. I guess it might be hard in some people's minds to put those two together because they think of it as being as charity, but this has become business, has it not?
Well, in fact, that's one of the big challenges facing the nonprofit world. Traditionally, I believe, and I'm painting with a broad brush now, people went into nonprofit work because they wanted to, because they cared about causes. That didn't necessarily mean that they had the skills to operate the charities in a business-like way. And increasingly, there are all sorts of resources available, and also funding from donors, whether those are individuals or institutions, to try to help charities become more effective and businesslike.
And with us alongside Todd Cohen, we have in the studio Fred Stang, who is with the Triangle Community Foundation. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you for having me.
Well, explain to us what exactly a community foundation is. How does that differ from, say, the Dukes and the Keenans of years past in North Carolina?
Well, the Triangle Community Foundation, or a community foundation, is a wonderful tool, sort of going back to what Todd was saying, where just about anyone can be a philanthropist and have the benefits of something like a private foundation. But it's actually not a private foundation. So a community foundation is really a community of donors. Each donor creates his or her own unique charitable fund. And then from those funds, grants are made back out to the community or to the causes that are important to the donor. And what's wonderful about a community foundation is that you don't have to come into a community foundation knowing what specific organizations you want to give to. You can come in and say, I want to support children's causes, or I want to support things that affect the environment. And the staff of a community foundation can help a donor really come up with a philanthropic plan that meets the donor's charitable goals.
So how does that work? You have somebody who comes in and says that they have $10,000 they want to give. Okay. Do you then find one cause that gets that $10,000 directly, so that donor's money is earmarked for that particular cause, or does it go into a big pool and?
Well, both. Actually, what we will do is set, if the donor wants to create a fund, let's say that honors their parents or carries on the family names, let's say the Jones Family Fund, then we would sit down with the Jones family, and it might be the mom and dad, or it might be the mom and dad and the children, and help them determine what is the best way to use those philanthropic dollars. And going back to the venture philanthropist, these are real dollars. This is not play money. And so most people want to invest their dollars in a charitable way that has a positive charitable return. You know, it has an impact on the environment, has an impact helping kids. But also, those assets at a community foundation are pooled together for investment purposes into usually, you know, pools of charitable funds, which help save dollars so more dollars can go for the charitable giving.
How did you yourself get into this?
Came at it through social work. I had worked for many years in working with kids who were troubled, domestic violence work for many, many years. And then that led into doing fundraising for the organization. And I met the right people and have the privilege of working at a community foundation now.
So I'm curious, with your background, what trends have you seen over the last decade or so, and what surprised you about that in philanthropy?
I'm not a scholar of philanthropy. I can really only tell you what I've seen locally, but I really have to underscore something that Todd said, and that is what we are seeing are people that are becoming more and more conscientious about their giving, who are not as satisfied to just give in a reactive mode, but really want to take their philanthropy as seriously as they take their other investments. So they're coming to the community foundation to tap into the expertise that community foundations have to help them fine-tune, maybe even build on a family tradition of philanthropy, but really take their philanthropy to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
We're also, let me just also, at least locally in the Triangle, with the growth of entrepreneurism here, we're seeing people get wealthy very quickly. And they might not have come from wealthy families themselves. And they're concerned about the values this wealth is going to have on their children. So they're looking at philanthropy as a way to teach values to their kids.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be talking with one in just a moment. But Todd Cohen, several years back there was a failure in the management of United Way. And it was a huge news story. So what efforts are being made now to run the nonprofits more efficiently? Does that get to what you were talking about earlier about treating them like businesses more? But I wonder if that adds an extra layer of administrative costs, et cetera, that then may not be going exactly to the charity itself that people have in mind, but overhead.
You've touched on a huge issue. What you're referring to happened about 10 years ago, but since then, on a fairly regular basis, there are news reports of scandals within the nonprofit world. In the last couple of years, there have been quite a few of these. And in particular, in the last couple of years, this has coincided with financial scandals in the business world. The impact of all that is that funders these days want to be very sure that they're giving money to organizations that are going to do a good job spending that money and investing it in their own programs. And what has happened is that nonprofit organizations are working a lot harder and they're much more conscientious about trying to be more effective and efficient in the use of that money.
Okay. We are talking on the state of things today about philanthropy with Todd Cohen, editor and publisher of the Philanthropy Journal, and Fred Stang of the Triangle Community Foundation. Coming up, we'll talk about one of the most historically significant philanthropic efforts in North Carolina history, and we're taking your emails at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and those listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and today we're talking about the state of philanthropy in North Carolina. With us are Todd Cohen, who is editor and publisher of the Philanthropy Journal, and Fred Stang, director of development at the Triangle Community Foundation. If you want to join our conversation, we're doing email today. Our email address is sot@wunc.org. Well, in the early part of the 20th century, Julius Rosenwald, the president of Sears Roebuck and Company in Chicago, teamed up with Booker T. Washington at the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama and built more than 5,000 schools for African Americans in the rural parts of the South in 15 southern states. Julius Rosenwald gave more than $4 million to the effort, and more than $4.7 million was raised by African Americans in matching grants to build these schools. Now, there are more Rosenwald schools in North Carolina than in any other state, 813 of them. Betty Murchison, who attended a Rosenwald school in Wake Forest, is on a philanthropic mission of her own to find and save the Rosenwald schools in North Carolina, and she joins us on the show today in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Betty Murchison, a little bit of the history. Why did Julius Rosenwald choose the education of African Americans in the South as his philanthropic effort?
Well, for one thing, Julius Rosenwald was very moved by reading Booker T. Washington's book, Up From Slavery. Documents the story of Booker T. Washington, who was born a slave, and how education, in essence, freed him. And he went on to become the head of Tuskegee Institute. And one of the things that Booker T. Washington found difficult was finding children to come into Tuskegee because there were very few public schools in the South that gave children the fundamental education they needed in order to begin taking classes at Tuskegee Institute. And so as a gift to Booker T. Washington on Rosenwald's 50th birthday, the $25,000 donation that he gave for the assistance with colleges, Booker T. Washington asked if he could use part of it to help with rural education.
For like elementary schools?
Yes.
High schools.
Exactly. And from this grew the Rosenwald Fund. Julius Rosenwald said, that'll be fine, but I want the communities to match it. So it's one of the first matching grant funds that I know about.
And so 813 of these schools were in North Carolina.
Yes.
And you attended one in Wake Forest. This is the
Du Bois Center.
Du Bois Center.
It was formerly Du Bois High School. It was built in 1926, and we are in an urgent recovery period now. We have a proposal on the table to construct the first National Rosenwald School Museum. We feel that since North Carolina had the most Rosenwald schools and that we're kind of centrally located in the state, that this would be a great site for a Rosenwald School Museum. There is a lot of interest in Rosenwald schools across the country. There have been conferences. We just attended a national conference in Nashville, Tennessee, sponsored by the National Trust. The National Trust has its own initiative, Rosenwald School Initiative, in an attempt to document and help people with the reclamation of Rosenwald schools throughout the country.
Now, the Rosenwald schools fell into disrepair and sometimes were abandoned after integration came about.
Yes.
But how long was the one in Wake Forest used? Until what year was it?
Schools were integrated in Wake County in 1970, and the campus became a middle school campus. And then in 1989, the campus was closed up and abandoned by the school system, and it remained boarded up for almost 10 years before my alumni association purchased the campus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when did you go to school there, if I might ask?
I went to school there during the 60s, And I wound up graduating from Wake Forest High School, Wake Forest Roseville High School, in 1971.
What was the school like? Were you in one of the buildings that was the Rosenwald School?
Yes. Well, the oldest building was the one constructed with Rosenwald funds. Mm-hmm. But that building was used on the campus up until the closure of the middle school. And it was interesting. It was like being in an incubator. I think for the most part, we were isolated from many of the problems that that were going on in the world. And I think a lot of my teachers were only a few years older than we were. They were fresh out of college, and they were providing a quality education, oftentimes without the tools that children in other communities had. But they insulated us from that. They had a goal that each child must succeed, because no one was able to determine which child would be the one and which one, you know, there was no room for failure.
Mm-hmm. No tracking, I gather, either.
No tracking, exactly.
Right. Well, and so right now you're trying to gather funds to make a museum there. I understand that there were 813 of them in North Carolina, but so many fell into disrepair that there might be communities where these buildings exist, but people don't know it?
That's exactly right. There is an effort afoot to document. There's a study list. We're trying to get Rosenwald schools identified and then to put them on the National Register of Historic Places so that there is some protection for the historical integrity of the buildings. We have there are a lot of volunteers throughout the community. Cultural Resources is very involved in that process. And as the chair of the North Carolina Rosenwald Coalition, we're also on the ground trying to make communities aware of what these buildings are and what a great resource they are, and helping them to identify adaptive reuses for them.
Would they all have had a similar architectural style?
Yes.
Because I understand Mr. Rosenwald, he came out of Sears Roebuck, and you know there were the Sears homes that you could buy by catalog. Was that style followed in these buildings too?
Well, these buildings were probably a lot better than the homes.
Okay.
He understood that they were going into communities where sometimes there was no electricity. So the design of the building, the architectural design of the buildings, was really fabulous. If you go into a Rosenwald building, you can cut the lights off and you could still see well enough to read and write because of the large bay windows that face to the sun. All of the designs were really laid out so carefully, where the privy would be, where your fresh water was, because these were mostly in very rural areas of the county. So the plans were so good that a lot of white schools started adopting the plans and copying the style. So sometimes it's very difficult. And because these were rural areas, we didn't have street names. And so you may know that there were 21 in Wake County, and some of the communities that they were put in, the communities no longer exist. So you have to do a lot of research to determine where the buildings are and then to determine if these are true Rosenwald buildings.
Okay. Well, Todd Cohen, Betty Murchison was talking about matching funds, and that was something that was that the Rosenwald schools may have been an early proponent of that. Were there other, do you hear other things in this story about Rosenwald that bear out today?
Actually, very much so. While philanthropy is changing, I think the example that Betty just talked about with Mr. Rosenwald is a perfect example of what philanthropy is all about. There's a real continuity. People see a need, and they try to do something to address it. Philanthropists invest their money and their time, because volunteers are philanthropists as well, in trying to address social needs. And I think today that's as big a challenge as ever, because the social needs that we face in this country are huge. Government is trying to cut back its support for social services. Taxpayers are in a mood where they don't want tax increases to pay for additional services. If anything, they want to pay for less. At the same time, trillions of dollars, and that's trillions with a T, over the next 50 years are going to change hands between generations, be transferred from the World War II generation to the baby boomers and from the boomers to the boomers' children. And at the same time, there are also a lot more nonprofits trying to address these needs, and donors and philanthropists and volunteers are looking for organizations that can do a good job addressing the causes that they care about. So donors out there, whether they're the Rockefellers of the world or Joe and Mary, regular person, are looking for organizations, one, that are involved with the causes they care about, and two, can do a good job. And because so many nonprofit organizations do not necessarily have the skills to be as businesslike as possible, a big challenge for philanthropists is to help nonprofits be stronger in terms of running their organizations.
You know, you mentioned a moment ago that there's a resistance to raising taxes, so that's where the philanthropies and charities jump into the fray. I've also heard it said that in the South, and North Carolina being part of the South, that a lot of times some of those charities fell on churches to do as well.
Most definitely. A big thrust of charity, or a big part of charity in this country, is through religious congregations and their social service missions and their outreach to the community. Part of what President Bush is trying to do is to direct more federal funds, and this is quite controversial because for a variety of reasons, including the constitutional provision that tries to separate church and state. But one of the things President Bush is trying to do is to get more money to these faith-based organizations, because in many communities, that's where that's how social service is addressed, through religious organizations. And in fact, of the roughly, I think it's $240 billion that is given to charity each year through individuals and foundations, through bequests and wills, and through corporations, the biggest single part of that, roughly a third, I believe, goes to religious causes.
Well, here's a philosophical question. Perhaps you can answer this, Fred Stang or Todd. What is the difference between charity and philanthropy? We use those terms almost interchangeably, and I'm wondering, is there a slight difference?
I'll defer to Fred. But I tend to use the words interchangeably. But a very wise philanthropy person once said to me that charity was essentially putting a Band-Aid on a problem, and philanthropy was an investment in trying to fix the roots of the problem.
Yeah, and I would have to agree. And I think going back to the Rosenwald story, I think one of the factors there was that here was an issue that was not being addressed by the government. Philanthropy was able to come in with an innovative and also very, very brave idea at the time that joined both the Rosenwald money with local support. There was philanthropy taking place by the very wealthiest in Rosenwald and some of the poorest who had to also contribute. And philanthropy does not have to be tax deductible. So much of what we do that is philanthropic, we don't write on our tax returns. It's given from the heart. It's given with just as much meaning, and has a very, very powerful impact on our community.
Well, Betty Murchison, in the case of the Rosenwald schools, that was, from what I understand about Julius Rosenwald, he didn't want to just give alms. It was a case of he wanted to have people have something invested. It almost sounds like the Habitat for Humanity model of today.
True, where you use sweat equity to sometimes to bring in ownership. And I think the communities were very willing to do whatever they needed to do. I know some farmers sold chickens, they sold their crops, sold cotton, or you know, would make pledges. And I mean, they really collected money, pennies and nickels and dimes at the time. But they had ownership in this when it was done. And there's great pride. There's still great pride. If you talk to alumni, members of any of these schools, it is overwhelming to hear their stories and what the school meant to them. So I think it was a wise plan.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today about philanthropy in North Carolina, and we go now to Michael Brader-Arahe, who is a full-time philanthropist. He is trustee of the Michael and Laura Brader-Arahe Foundation and managing partner of True Pilot. It's a locally based venture capital investment firm. Of course, listeners to WUNC may be familiar with his name because WUNC is one of the many projects that Michael and his foundation support. Welcome to the State of Things, Michael.
Hey, Melinda. Thanks for having me.
Hi there. Well, I'm curious, was this a career goal for you to become a full-time philanthropist? You're relatively young as philanthropists go.
Well, I mean, I've always been civic-minded, but, you know, I never realized that I was ever going to come into the kind of wealth that I came into. And when I did, I realized I had a tremendous, tremendous opportunity and a tremendous responsibility to try to do good with some of that money. And it just has been a natural progression. I would say that even after I accumulated some of that wealth, I didn't sit down one day and make the decision, well, I'm going to become a full-time philanthropist. That has been something that has happened very gradually as I get more and more involved in the community.
Mm-hmm. So how do you run your foundation? How do you make decisions on where your money is going to go?
Well, you know, we don't have a huge staff. It's basically just me and my wife. When we look at a variety of opportunities, we try to focus on what interests us. You know, I've found in philanthropy, as well as lots of other things in life, if you're passionate about what you give money to, you tend to do a better job, and you're more effective in giving away your money, and you're more effective in helping the organizations that you give money to. So for us, it flows really from the personal interests, which for us are education, women's issues, children's issues, and things related to that.
Mm-hmm. So how is your foundation different from what Fred Stang does with the Triangle Community Foundation?
Well, I think Fred does a great job at the Triangle Community Foundation in terms of helping people decide where to best spend their energies as well as how to leverage their dollars. But I think he caters more to folks that are part-time philanthropists. And since I'm doing this as a full-time gig, I really am focusing all my energies on administering the foundation. I've got a lot more time to do this sort of thing than most other folks that are working together with Fred.
Mm-hmm. What surprised you most about becoming a full-time philanthropist?
How hard it is. You know, Bill Gates once said that he found it much harder to give away his money effectively than it was to earn it. And I've been living that these last 4 years, that I find that is really true.
Now, what makes it hard?
Well, you know, as an entrepreneur, one of the greatest thrills when I started my business, my for-profit business, was how exciting it was to create something from nothing. But the metric for success was so simple, and that was the bottom line. How much money did we make? In the nonprofit world, it's much, much more sophisticated. It's much more complicated. It's not just the bottom line number. You know, how do you measure how many hearts you've touched? How do you measure how many minds you've changed? It's very, very difficult to do that. It can be done, but it's a lot more sophisticated and a lot more challenging.
Okay. Well, Michael, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael Brader-Arahe is a full-time philanthropist. He's trustee of the Michael and Laura Brader-Arahe Foundation. It's based in Research Triangle Park. Fred Stang, would you agree with what Michael said there about how the difficulty sometimes of giving away money?
Well, I think it is hard. I think most people tend to be reactive in their giving. Someone they know asked them to give, or something affected their family. You know, a lot of people give to cancer organizations when they know someone personally who was affected by it. But he's absolutely right. I think it does take some time and energy to really think through where you want to have an impact with your dollars. And that's certainly what we do at the Triangle Community Foundation with the fund holders there. Really spending time with folks, having them think through, you know, if what affects them when they listen to the radio, when they watch TV, when they read the newspaper, and where can they have an impact with the dollars they have available to them?
Mm-hmm. Todd Cohen?
All three organizations that were represented today, the Rosenwald Schools, the Community Foundation, the Breder Arahe Foundation, are all examples of the variety of philanthropy in this country, which really has a remarkable tradition of philanthropy. Back, one of the very first things that one of the first observers of our society, de Tocqueville, found was that there were groups known as associations. And I think he was referring to them maybe in the political sense, but nevertheless, he saw something unique in this country, which were people saw a need that wasn't being addressed by business or by government, and they got together and they figured out a way to address the need. And the way that those needs are addressed comes in many forms and fashions. There's an old biblical, I think it's biblical, a story about the difference between giving a hungry person a fish and teaching them to fish. And I think that what we're seeing today increasingly are philanthropists, whether they're wealthy or whether they're just regular people, giving away their time or their money or their brain power, their know-how, to help organizations do a better job of teaching people in need in this country to fish. And it comes in many forms and fashions, but basically everybody can do it. Everybody can help by either volunteering or giving away their money or their know-how.
Well, I'd like to thank you all for coming in and volunteering your time today to talk about this. Thank you so much. Todd Cohen is editor and publisher of the Philanthropy Journal. Fred Stang is director of development at the Triangle Community Foundation. And Betty Murchison is the executive director of the Du Bois Center in Wake Forest and chair of the North Carolina Rosenwald Commission. You can get information on that at our website, wunc.org. Just ahead, a conversation with an award-winning teen from Guilford County who won an award for her photography. And also remembering North Carolina artist Maud Gatewood. All that ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. This summer, Gabby Salazar won the Young Wildlife Photographer of the Year Award from BBC Wildlife Magazine and the Natural History Museum in London. Gabby Salazar is a 17-year-old from Pleasant Garden in Guilford County and attends early college at Guilford. It's a dual enrollment program between high school and college. Her winning photograph was of a green anole. And we welcome Gabby to the program. Hi there, Gabby.
Hi.
Well, congratulations on winning this award.
Thank you very much.
Well, thousands of people were in the running. How'd you feel when you heard you'd won?
I definitely jumped around a little bit. It's considered to be the most prestigious competition in nature photography, so it was sort of a shot in the dark when I sent my entries in.
Well, the winning photo for you was a green anole. And could you describe for us exactly what that is and what your photograph looked like?
It's a reptile, and it's a type of lizard. It's similar to a chameleon in that it changes colors when it jumps from plant to plant. It goes from brown to green in different shades. The picture that I took was an anole on a green plant, and he was camouflaged. He was in some pretty nice light, and he actually did not have up his defense mechanism, which is a major characteristic of anoles. They have a small skin flap that's pink that comes down from their neck to show that they're trying to intimidate predators. And my photograph showed him completely camouflaged in his relaxed state without the flap.
So that would be considered somewhat rare because an anole, I guess, would be aware that a photographer is around and would have that defense mechanism down, usually.
Sometimes photographers do try to capture the defense mechanism because it is beautiful. It's pink, and it contrasts with the green of the anole. But he definitely was not aware that I was there, and I was only a few inches away from him, so yes.
You must be very quiet.
Yes, very still and very quiet. It took quite a while to get him into the position that I wanted.
So how long were you waiting there, taking that picture?
About 20 or 30 minutes, working with him in different locations. He had crawled onto a prickly pear cactus, and then he had finally come into the leaves.
So where did you take this picture that there was a cactus nearby?
I was shooting in southern Texas, Weslaco, which is about, and I could get this very wrong, 30 minutes, 45 minutes away from the Mexican border. So it really was southern Texas. And I was at a Valley Nature Center taking photographs and scouting for insects.
Now, is this something you do a lot on in your free time, to go to places where you could take these kind of photos?
Yes, yes. My parents have been very, very supportive of my photography. I started taking pictures when I was 12, and when I was 14, they started to let me travel to different locations as long as I had adults waiting for me there. And I've been to quite a few states, and I've been out of the country twice. So, yes, I travel quite a bit.
And most recently out of the country to pick up this award in London.
Yes, that was very nice.
Did you take any photos while you were there?
I took some travel photography. Just some touristy shots. I'm not really a people photographer, and there wasn't a lot of wildlife. I did take some photographs of pigeons, but...
Some in London might consider those wildlife, you know?
Definitely.
So wildlife is what you take photos of. Why do you take photographs?
I've always loved being outside, and having my camera with me is just sort of a supplement. And I find so much beauty in nature and the way the light plays on different colors. I love watching animals and birds and seeing their behaviors. And so wildlife photography, it's just really, really a source of happiness for me. I don't want it to become so competitive that I don't enjoy it anymore. So right now it's just a breakaway.
Do you want to do this for a career?
I'd like to. It's very, very competitive. The industry is hard to break into. I'm really, really focused on my academics. I'm interested in biochemistry. And so I'm definitely going to get a college degree and then possibly pursue photography in conjunction with another career.
What kind of camera do you use?
I use a Nikon F5. It's a professional body in the Nikon series.
So is that a digital camera, or are you still using film?
I'm still shooting film.
Do you do digital at all?
I shoot digital for portraits, and that's a way that I make money to help fund my trips. I'm not quite ready to switch to digital. A lot of my friends have already, but for me, there's just something about being able to hold a slide or a negative in my hand and not have it on a computer screen.
Your winning entry then was not changed by the computer, because, of course, there are programs these days that you can do so much altering of the photo.
Yes, it was not. It was on a transparency slide. And I do scan in my images at home so that I can print them and then sell them or frame them. But I don't like altering my images. I like them to look exactly like they look on the slide or the negative, because I just get a feeling in my stomach, a bad feeling, when I alter them, because it's not like it looked when I saw it outside.
And, of course, you've waited 20 to 30 minutes to take the picture, as you did in this case, so...
Yes, I wait for the light. I don't like to change it on the computer.
That's very admirable.
Well, there are quite a few photographers like that.
Now, I have heard that this award is not your first.
No, this is actually my second international award. I won a photography competition called Nature's Best International Photography Competition last year. I won the Youth Grand Prize, and I had a photograph displayed in the Smithsonian Natural History Museum.
And what was that a photograph of?
That was a photograph of a honeybee flying into a sunflower, and the honeybee was stopped in midair.
So having your photograph at the Smithsonian must be pretty heady. Did you go up there to see it?
Yes. I went to the opening, and there was a wonderful award ceremony. I got to meet a lot of incredible people and to speak in one of their auditoriums, which was very nice. So it's definitely overwhelming to see your photograph in a museum like that and to be around other photographers whose names I've heard since I started photography.
Like, who did you meet there?
Art Wolf, who's a very, very famous professional. He was one of our speakers. And Nancy Rotenberg, who's a macro photographer. This year in London, I met a woman named Tui de Roy, And she's a woman who started photography very young as well, and she's photographed. She grew up in the Galapagos Islands. So just a lot of very inspiring photographers.
Where do you want to go to college?
I have my sights set on Grinnell College in Iowa. It's sort of, you know, in Iowa, and I keep getting, oh, that's in the middle of cornfields, but it's a wonderful, wonderful institution. Their academic standards are very high, and they have great sciences.
When people say it's in the middle of cornfields, are they saying what kind of wildlife could you find there, do you think?
Yeah, pretty much.
And what do you say to that? Do you think that you can find wildlife anywhere, or do you have to go to exotic places to find it?
You know, I take a lot of my photographs in my backyard, and I don't mean just, you know, walking outside of my back door, but within a few miles of my home, you definitely don't have to go to exotic locations. And I've done a lot of research on Iowa, and there's a bald eagle migration that's not too far off. There's the Badlands, you know, 5 or 6 hours drive. You can find photographs anywhere.
What's your favorite photograph that you've taken?
There's actually a new one that I took over the summer. I spent about 4 weeks on a ranch in southern Texas, and I took a photograph of a ribbon snake, and he is poking his head out of a pool, and there's a perfect reflection and a water droplet that had just fallen on the water to ripple the water. And that was just a very special moment for me because I was shooting birds, and all of a sudden I saw him out of the corner of my eye, and it's just a very rare moment to get him poking his head up and to stay still for that long.
So that was by surprise to you, because I was wondering if, like with the anole, that you might have sat there for 30 minutes trying to wait for the snake to pop his head up.
This was one of those moments where my heart was beating incredibly fast because the light was right and he was right, and I had literally a minute to get it.
Now, Gabby Salazar, I understand that your photos are on display more locally at a restaurant in the area?
We did have some photographs displayed at Tex and Shirley's restaurant, which is in Friendly Center. They're not going to be up there for the winter season, but we will have some back up in the spring.
And Friendly Center, is that a town or is that an area in your town?
That's Friendly Shopping Center. It's in Greensboro. It's one of our major mall locations.
Oh, great. Now, have they always displayed your photos there?
Since I was about 13, our photography group called Boca Photography Club displays there. So I only have 2 or 3 photographs up at a time.
If people want to see your photos, then they can see them in the spring there?
They can see them in the spring, and I'll have photographs online in various places.
So you take portrait pictures of people, digital?
Yes, yes.
Oh. And is that very lucrative?
It can be. I haven't had as much time this year because I'm balancing the college schedule, but when I get it going and I actually do 2 or 3 sets a weekend, yes, it helps to fund my trips to Russia and other places. That was the main source for that trip. My parents make me pay for everything when it comes to photography.
So, if might I ask how much a trip to Russia would cost to take photographs?
Oh, that one I think was around $2,500, including plane ticket, and we stayed for 3 weeks.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today, and a lot of luck in the future.
Thank you very much. It was nice to speak to you.
Gabby Salazar attends early college at Guilford, and she is the winner of the Young Wildlife Photographer of the Year Award. She joined us from her home in Pleasant Garden in Guilford County. Maude Gatewood was arguably North Carolina's premier painter of the last quarter century. Her works hang in the National Museum of the Women in the Arts, the North Carolina Museum of Art, and among many collections, including those of Duke University, Wilmington St. John's Museum, and the Keenan Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Maude Gatewood's awards include the Painting Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the North Carolina Award in Fine Arts. Early in her career, she helped found the art program at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and later taught at Central Piedmont Community College in Charlotte. Maude Gatewood passed away last Monday, November 8th, after a 2-month decline brought on by several strokes. Poet Jeffrey Beam has this remembrance.
Maude Gatewood grew up on a farm in Yanceyville as the last leaf on Caswell County's first family's tree. Carrying a leather holster and toy gun, she rode with her sheriff father as he busted illegal moonshiners. The family farmstead Gatewood still stands and serves as the county's historical museum. As a young girl at Woman's College in Greensboro, she met the painters Franz Klein and Philip Guston. She hoped to impress Klein with a copycat homage to his work. He, instead, saw her true work buried within and asked her what she, herself, intended to paint next. During her 2 summers in 1952 and 53 at Burnsville School of Fine Arts, she visited Black Mountain College, which exposed her to John Cage's chance experiments and Merce Cunningham's radical dance turns. Through a Fulbright scholarship, she traveled to Vienna and Salzburg to study with Oskar Kokoschka, whom she disliked, and about Goya with art historian Fritz Novotny. Goya's tough, grotesque cultural critiques remained embedded in her work throughout her career. After a short flirtation in the 1970s with the New York art world, she chose to turn her attention to North Carolina, realizing that what she had to say was nurtured by her native landscape and people, no less universal than that of New York, France, or Italy. Through the years, she fertilized her work with travels to exotic places such as Mongolia, Iran, and India, and thus made paintings of those places as local and pure in accent as of the places we recognize. After returning home to Caswell County, she served as a county commissioner, fondly describing the experience as just me and the boys. As her painting evolved from her early, more fluid work to the constrained, organized, even flattened and distant style of her maturity, her immense knowledge of the world and her wry outlook on human foibles energized the images. There's something wild and primitive about her landscapes, even when touched by the hand or threat of the hand of man, yet she presented them in controlled and hard-edged forms. Her people reveal themselves self-assuredly awkward and ignorant, or noble and tender, blemishes and all. Maud once said, "If you walk down the street, how many pretty people do you see? I'm painting what I see." Her paintings are seldom pretty, but always beautiful, either eerily or plainly so. Mostly representational, her forms move toward abstraction to separate the viewer for just a moment, and then, through her genius for pairing contrasting colors, or making harmonious monochromatic scenes, or showing exhilarating movement or tumult in stillness, she pulls the viewer in, tricked into feeling what she saw, forcing possibilities. Maud transformed native pastoral sensibilities into analytical impulses, at once honoring the natural world and the human condition, while describing the forces that threatened and transformed them. She loved the shapes and bustle of the real world too much to obliterate them. Maud once told the News and Observer, "There's nothing worse than being pleasant." She did not suffer fools, but was loved, revered, and dreaded for her blunt, cantankerous wisdom and respected for her loyalty, generosity, and wide-ranging enthusiasms. Her work forms a bridge between the porches and fields we natives remember and the pavement and skylines that imperil us. They are proof that one can praise the simple delights of being without sentimentality and with serious and reasoned intent while creating works of impassioned response. No people die, but worlds die in them. When the Russian poet Yevtushenko wrote these words, he could have been speaking of Maud Gatewood. We are lucky that in her 70 years she exposed so many of her worlds to us. Their droll judgments enliven, chastise, and improve us. Their style challenges us. Their homage inspires us. Yesterday, she was laid to rest in the family church cemetery in Yanceyville, near the town square, close to the people, fields, cows, and sky that nurtured her beginnings.
Jeffrey Beam is a poet and editor of the Oyster Boy Review. His latest work is a CD collection called What We Have Lost, New and Selected Poems. He performs on December 9th at UNC in Winter Stories for Children of All Ages. You can see a 50-year retrospective of Maud Gatewood's work. It's hanging in the Hodges Taylor Gallery in Charlotte through December 24th. And for today, that's the state of things. If you have a comment about our program, our email address is sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Penn Cava. Thanks for listening.